predict what will be next. We humans make patterns anyway, creating constellations and then stories to explain the constellations. And just as the Greeks and Romans invoked stories of the gods to explain the constellations, Orion's Belt, Cassiopeia, so too, as we've seen, did they ascribe geologic phenomena to the divine. This belief explained an otherwise inexplicable aspect of the natural world, relieving the desire to understand why one generation suffered and another did not. However, as Pompeians found, no amount of ritual could offer you control. Nothing could. This was a feeling perhaps familiar to many Romans, whose lives could just as easily be destroyed at the whim of their human rulers. As Greco-Roman culture unspooled itself, Jewish culture was developing a different conception of God and his interaction with the human world. The Jews rejected the idea of gods as selfish and petty. They believed in an inherently good, loving God with whom a covenant could be made. But if God was good, then how could we explain the human suffering in earthquakes, floods, and volcanic eruptions? The Jewish answer was that the fault must lie in ourselves. Many ancient cultures have defining flood stories, but in the story of Noah, it is the flood victims and not their God who are responsible. The story of Sodom and Gomorrah makes the connection even more explicit. Describing what sounds distinctly like a pyroclastic flow, the book of Genesis reads, "Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah sulfur and fire from the Lord out of heaven." It happens because 10 good men could not be found among all the inhabitants of the cities. The Bible repeatedly cites earthquakes and high winds as a sign of God's displeasure with man. "The earth rocked and shook," says the book of Psalms. "The bases of the mountains trembled and reeled because of God's anger." Contemporary Christian and Jewish writers attributed the destruction of Pompeii to the sacking of Jerusalem by Rome 9 years earlier. The Roman general who had led the siege and destruction of Jerusalem, Titus, had become emperor exactly 2 months before the eruption. A first-century graffito on the wall of the ruins of Pompeii illustrates the connection. "Sodom and Gomorrah," it reads. Such belief not only justifies why a good God could allow evil to happen, it provides an illusion of control. If disasters are a punishment for sins, then a pure life offers salvation. Jews and Christians throughout the ages remained mostly satisfied with this interpretation. It cohered with ideas of predestination, a more deterministic worldview. However, as Western theology developed, some found it hard to accept that no innocents were killed in natural disasters. Although the apparently pious priest might hide some horrible sin, the babes in arms simply could not. The ideas of St. Augustine of Hippo, furthered by St. Thomas Aquinas, developed as a means to reconcile ourselves with this dilemma. They invoked God's need to give us free will. God made us free to choose good or evil. He cannot absolve us of our evil after we've made such a choice. We have to live with the consequences of our decisions. This is straightforward enough as an explanation of war, for instance, but it stumbles a bit when applied to natural disasters. Especially without an understanding of the physical causes, the occurrence of an earthquake after centuries of quiet strikes us as deeply unfair. St. Augustine called such disasters natural evils, and believed that creation itself had been corrupted by the fall of Adam and Eve, so that natural disasters were reflecting the evil choices of the fallen angels. St. Thomas argued that the evil of suffering in disasters was necessary for some goodness, such as bravery and compassion, to be realized. It is for this reason that God allows natural evils to persist. What such arguments did not yet comprehend is that natural hazards are part and parcel of the systems that make life possible on our planet. The distribution of heat through the atmosphere that coalesces into storms is the same movement necessary to bring water out of the oceans to rain upon land. A planet without earthquakes would be one without mountains and valleys with which to trap clouds, or faults to trap groundwater and bring it to the surface in springs. Natural disasters, as we've seen, are a consequence of the inevitable fluctuations in the natural environment necessary to support life. An argument for free will makes a different kind of sense today. Suffering from natural disasters can be seen as a consequence of human choice. But it is visited upon us for our failure to build sufficiently strong buildings, to adequately maintain our water pipes, at a time when science and experience allow us to know better. In this light, we see the straightforward moral failing of putting personal short-term gain over the health and safety of our family and others in our community. But for as long as disasters were seen as divinely ordained, even the study of the physical causes of disasters was limited. The belief that earthquakes were sent by God remained unchallenged for millennia, until the evidence to the contrary became too hard for many to refute. Chapter 2. Bury the Dead and Feed the Living. Lisbon, Portugal, 1755. But how conceive a God supremely good, who heaps his favors on the sons he loves, yet scatters evil with as large a hand? Voltaire, Poem on the Lisbon Disaster. In 1755, Lisbon was the fourth largest city in Europe, after London, Paris, and Vienna. Built on the mouth of the Tagus, the port of Lisbon was one of Europe's largest, bringing in riches from the New World. Its throne was fed by gold and diamonds from the mines in its colony in Brazil. After a muddled royal succession entwined with the Spanish throne that had threatened its independence, Portugal had reestablished its sovereignty and was ruled by King Joseph I. The country was devoutly Catholic, and both the legal and educational systems reinforced the devotion. The universities and most other educational institutions were run by the Jesuits. The Inquisition was still underway, with autos da fé, acts of faith, that made public spectacles of the penance of heretics, including those whose sins required burning at the stake. Meanwhile, the Enlightenment was bubbling up through other parts of Europe. With the scientific revolution, a developing intellectualism had arisen, embracing economics, philosophy, political science, and natural philosophy, coalescing into ideas and disciplines that would change the world. From Descartes' mathematics to Adam Smith's economic theories, people were debating the nature of society and trying to improve it. In Portugal, the devout Catholicism and the strong grip of the Jesuits on the educational system set it apart from some of the other great countries, constraining its intellectual evolution. King Joseph I, who 5 years earlier had ascended the throne at the age of 36, enjoyed absolute rule. He had been married at the age of 15 to the daughter of the King of Spain. As his older sister was married to his wife's brother, the future King Ferdinand VI of Spain. King Joseph was by all accounts quite an intelligent man, but he put much of his energy into music and the hunt, the great interests of his wife, which, as we will see, may have saved his life. With little interest in government, the king had appointed 3 secretaries of state for internal, foreign, and military affairs, and trusted them to handle most of the decisions of governance. Sebastio José de Carvalho y Malo was the Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs and quickly rose to be the dominant force in government. De Carvalho had a very late start to public life. The son of a country squire, he was supposed to become a lawyer, studying at the University of Coimbra. He left in frustration, although it is hard to tell whether it was the rigidity of the Jesuit curriculum or the rigors of academic discipline that drove him out. He tried the army, enlisting as a private, but military life also did not agree with him. His service was brief. Lacking direction, he spent a decade whiling away his time as a man about town in Lisbon. The 19th century Oxford historian Morse Stevens wrote of him, "His handsome face, great bodily strength, and proficiency in athletic exercises made him popular in all circles of society in the capital, in spite of his comparative poverty. He was a popular guest at all the parties of the aristocracy, at least until he eloped with the niece of one of the most powerful noblemen of the kingdom. Her family tried to get the marriage annulled, but the lady herself was not interested in losing this husband. Her family finally decided to make the best of the situation and arranged for De Carvalho to be made ambassador to London at the age of 40 in 1739. In London, De Carvalho seems to have finally come into his own. He successfully positioned Portugal in the court of St. James and nurtured a close relationship with England, in spite of their country's religious differences. His stay in London expanded his view of the world. He saw the commercial might of the British Empire and studied the politics and economics that fostered British success. In 1745, he was recalled to Lisbon and then sent as a special envoy to Austria to negotiate a difficult settlement between the Austrian court and the Pope. A French diplomat at the time described De Carvalho's service. "In these affairs," he wrote, "he afforded many proofs of his skill, wisdom, uprightness, and amiability, and especially of his great patience. He is noble without ostentation, wise and prudent. He is a good citizen of the world." By the time of his return to Portugal in 1749, De Carvalho had become convinced of the value of strong governmental investment in infrastructure in support of the economy, not to mention the value of secularization, especially in education. Empowered by King Joseph, De Carvalho set about trying to reform the Portuguese state. He established a central bank and worked to foster and protect various industries. He suspected the stranglehold by the Jesuits on Portuguese intellectual thought was holding Portugal back, but it was difficult to oppose them in such a devoutly Catholic country. More than 200,000 of Portugal's 3 million citizens were in a convent or monastery. The Inquisition had shaped Portugal, where blood purity laws kept track of the new Christians, descended from the Jews and Moors who had been forcibly converted in the 15th century, so that old Christians could avoid contaminating their family lines in such marriages. Early in his tenure as Secretary of State, Di Carvalho worked with Jesuits to solidify his standing. But he also worked to limit their authority. In 1751, he secured the Pope's agreement that Jesuit inquisitors could not unilaterally impose a death sentence, but must get the agreement of the government. By the arrival of All Saints' Day, November 1, 1755, he was already seen as the de facto ruler of Portugal. Many are surprised to learn that a great earthquake, one above magnitude 8, ever took place in Europe. Wherever there are earthquakes, the ratio of large to small earthquakes is stable. That means that places where smaller earthquakes happen are those more likely to see big ones. And while the region surrounding Portugal shows some earthquake activity, there's not nearly as much as in neighboring regions, especially in southeastern Europe. But in the same way that a high concentration of small earthquakes doesn't necessarily mean a big one is coming soon, the absence of small earthquakes doesn't mean an area is immune to one. How big is limited only by the length of the fault available to break. From our understanding of plate tectonics, we know that Africa is moving into Europe, pushing up the Alps, causing the earthquakes in Greece, Italy, and Turkey, as well as creating the volcanoes of Etna and Vesuvius. West of Gibraltar, this compression continues along the Azores-Gibraltar seismic zone. And indeed, numerous earthquakes of magnitude 6 to 7 have been recorded there since 1900. But because they are far enough offshore, those smaller earthquakes haven't caused damage and have been largely overlooked. The All Saints' Day earthquake of 1755 is by far the largest earthquake that zone has produced in human history. The usual method of determining magnitude today, measuring ground motion on a seismograph, obviously can't help us capture the magnitude of earthquakes that predate such technology. But we know that the energy released in an earthquake is a product of both the area of a fault that moves, more on this later, and also the distance one side moves across the other, the slip. We can use that geologic information to estimate the magnitude after the fact. That becomes challenging when the fault we want to look at is underwater, as it was with Lisbon. If it generates a tsunami, we can estimate the size of the fault and thus the magnitude from the amount of water in the tsunami. But clearly with old data, any estimates are going to be rough. A third way to determine magnitude is to look at how large an area was damaged and where shaking was felt. All these approaches have been applied to the Lisbon earthquake, and the smallest estimated magnitude is 8.5. The largest is 9.0. Lisbon was at the northern end of the heavily damaged region, but all the Portuguese coast south of Lisbon was just as heavily shaken. It adds up to a truly massive earthquake, one that had to have had an originating fault on the order of 200 or more miles long. All Saints is a holy day of obligation, meaning all practicing Catholics are required to go to Mass. All the churches, and there were many in Lisbon, were running multiple services through the morning to accommodate worshipers. The servants probably went to earlier services so they could be back at work preparing the feasts to celebrate the day. The gentry and nobility would likely have been at the 9 a.m. service. A notable exception was the royal family. Their preference for horses and the hunt led them to go to the early service so they could head to their country estate to enjoy the holiday. Those in the churches would have been squeezed into crowded pews, making a quick escape impossible. And to further complicate matters, the large churches had multiple side chapels, every one of them with their own altar, every altar supporting lit candles. The shaking began at 9:40 a.m. With such a large earthquake, the rupture had to move down a long fault, which means the shaking likely lasted for 3 to 5 minutes. It began with a light level of shaking that grew in intensity. The Reverend Charles Davy, an English clergyman who was living in Lisbon, later described it thus. "The table I was writing on began to tremble with a gentle motion, which rather surprised me, as I could not perceive a breath of wind stirring. Whilst I was reflecting with myself what this could be owing to, but without having the least apprehension of the real cause, the whole house began to shake from the very foundation, which at first I imputed to the rattling of several coaches in the main street, which usually passed that way at this time from Belen to the palace. But on hearkening more attentively, I was soon undeceived, as I found it was owing to a strange, frightful kind of noise underground, resembling the hollow, distant rumbling of thunder. All this passed in less than a minute. The sudden slip of a fault in an earthquake twists the ground around it, creating two principal types of waves. P waves compress the ground, and they travel at the speed of sound. Sound is a compressive wave itself. Davy's noise underground would have been the P wave. S waves, on the other hand, twist the ground. They travel at a slower speed, but are bigger than P waves. The time between the two grows at a rate of 1 second per 5 miles of distance the waves have traveled. If the time between the arrival of the P and S waves is 30 seconds, we can deduce that the earthquake originated 150 miles away. The S wave was a completely different experience. Davy wrote, "I was stunned with a most horrid crash, as if every edifice in the city had tumbled down at once. The house I was in shook with such violence that the upper stories immediately fell. And though my apartment, which was the first floor, did not then share the same fate, yet everything was thrown out of its place in such a manner that it was with no small difficulty I kept my feet, and expected nothing less than to be soon crushed to death, as the walls continued rocking to and fro in the frightfulest manner, opening in several places, large stones falling down on every side from the cracks, and the ends of most of the rafters starting out from the roof." Imagine those who sat in pews at church, feeling that first gentle wave. At first, they might have wondered if they'd imagined it. Then a stronger wave came, and they looked at their neighbors, trying to decide what to do. No way to get out with all those people around them. Then the S wave hit, and a part of the building collapsed. Lit candles struck people, tapestries, books, the shaking not stopping until the whole building finally collapsed. We can only imagine their terror. Many people died, crushed by buildings, especially in the churches. A very large aftershock came minutes later to finish the job, leveling many of the buildings that had survived the first round. Those who could had by then exited the buildings, many choosing to congregate near the river quay to be away from the demolition that was taking place around them. It seemed safer, but it put them in the path of a tsunami, which arrived just after the first large aftershock. Tsunamis begin when the shape of the seafloor changes suddenly. The Lisbon earthquake was probably on a thrust fault, where the ground on one side is pushed up and over the other side, creating a new higher ridge on the seafloor. The water above the ridge is pushed upward, but being water, it immediately flows down to the lower side. This creates a wave that then moves toward shore. And because the whole column of seawater above the fault is moved, there is a lot of energy in such a wave. The deeper the sea at that point, the more water in the wave. As it approaches shore and the depth of the sea decreases, the height of the wave increases. When it comes to the mouth of a river, as it did with the Tagus in Lisbon, the wave will travel up the river, causing sloshing between the banks with very strong currents that can continue for hours. Davy had joined many others in heading to the riverside to get away from the falling buildings and was astonished by what he saw. He wrote, "Turning my eyes towards the river, which in that place is nearly 4 miles broad, I could perceive it heaving and swelling in the most unaccountable manner, as no wind was stirring. In an instant, there appeared at some small distance a large body of water, rising as it were like a mountain. It came on, foaming and roaring, and rushed towards the shore with such impetuosity that we all immediately ran for our lives as fast as possible. Many were actually swept away, and the rest above their waist in water at a good distance from the banks. For my own part, I had the narrowest escape, and should certainly have been lost, had I not grasped a large beam that lay on the ground, till the water returned to its channel, which it did almost at the same instant, with equal rapidity. When it seemed like it couldn't get any worse, it did. All those candles, lit on the altars to celebrate the Mass, had begun setting flame to carved wooden statues, embroidered altar cloths, old prayer books. The flames spread, and there was no organized approach to fighting them. By nightfall, the fires had engulfed all that remained of the city and continued to burn for 6 days. 85% of the buildings in Lisbon were destroyed, either by the earthquake or by the fires. The damage was worse along the river, where the loose river sediments had amplified the shaking. As this was the historic center of the city, these were the most significant buildings, the palaces, archives, and churches. Nor was Lisbon the only city affected. Most of the towns on the southern coast were badly damaged or destroyed. As is common with historic events, estimates of casualties vary widely, but the soberest sources suggest 40 to 50,000 dead, with three-quarters of those deaths occurring in Lisbon. While the Lisbon earthquake is remembered as the greatest natural disaster to strike Europe, it should also be remembered as the first significant response of a central government to a natural disaster. It still stands as one of the most effective. The royal palace in Lisbon was completely destroyed, but as the royal family had left town earlier that morning, the court eventually gathered around the king at the small palace of Belém, outside Lisbon. The king is said to have exclaimed to Di Carvalho, "What is to be done to meet this infliction of divine justice?" Di Carvalho's calm reply became legend. "Sire, we bury the dead and feed the living." He quickly took charge of what remained of the government, and by all accounts, his decisive action inspired only gratitude and obedience in that traumatic time. For the next 8 days, Di Carvalho lived in his carriage, mobilizing a response and reestablishing control. Guards were stationed around the outskirts of Lisbon to prevent able-bodied residents from leaving, forcing them instead to stay in the city and help, removing debris and creating adequate shelters for the survivors. To prevent looting, gallows were constructed at several high points of the city, providing summary justice to those caught in the act. More than 30 people were executed in the next month. Di Carvalho promulgated 200 decrees to maintain order and start recovery. Some were done so quickly that they were written against his knees in pencil and sent to their destinations without even being copied. These decrees covered many of the functions familiar to modern responders. Arrange shelter and food for the homeless, treat the wounded, forbid exploitative pricing, reestablish schools and churches. There were too many bodies to bury before decomposition turned them into a public health nightmare. So the bodies were cast into the sea, tied to heavy weights, despite Jesuit opposition. Di Carvalho's greatest insight was recognizing the need to expedite recovery, to give people hope, and just as important, to keep them in place. On December 4, 1755, barely a month after the earthquake, the chief engineer of the realm presented to the king four options for the recovery. They included abandoning Lisbon, rebuilding with recycled materials, rebuilding while widening some streets and making improvements to reduce future fire damage, and building a new city completely. With aid from other European countries, especially England, the king chose the most ambitious plan. In less than a year, Lisbon had been cleared of debris and reconstruction had begun. Di Carvalho became the hero of Lisbon. The king named him prime minister to give him complete power to enact the reconstruction. A few years later, he was given the title Marquês de Pombal. He succeeded in the complete rebuilding of Lisbon and was widely credited with saving many lives in the aftermath. He required that new buildings be constructed to withstand future earthquakes. Scale models were built, their resistance to shaking tested by having the army march around them. The style of construction that resulted is called Pombaline in his honor. For his part, King Joseph remained psychologically scarred by the earthquake. He developed severe claustrophobia, insisting on living the rest of his life in tents. He relied ever more on Di Carvalho to run the country and never questioned his work. Only after the king's death did his daughter, Queen Maria I, begin the construction of a new royal palace. Di Carvalho also undertook the first scientific survey of an earthquake. He sent queries to every parish church with a set of questions. When did the earthquake start and how long did it last? How many people died? Did the sea rise first or fall? The data from his survey has been used by modern scientists to better estimate the source and magnitude of the earthquake. Di Carvalho's success cemented his political authority and enabled him to enact his ambitious plans for the modernization of Portugal. His biggest coup was removing the Jesuits from their positions of power. He deemed them a danger to an absolute monarch, but also an obstacle to the country's intellectual advancement. Before the earthquake, he had succeeded only in establishing that the government had to approve an execution ordered by the Inquisition. Just 2 years after the earthquake, Di Carvalho had the Jesuits barred from the Portuguese court altogether. The next year, they were barred from engaging in trade, and in 1759, having caught them engaging in a plot against the king, he succeeded in confiscating their holdings and secularizing all the universities. The Lisbon earthquake's physical shaking was felt across much of Europe, as far north as Scandinavia. Occurring at the height of the Great Enlightenment, the earthquake brought about just as profound a philosophical shaking, resonating across broader Europe for decades. At a time when the roles of rational thought and religious faith were being questioned, the deep feeling of unfairness generated by the Lisbon earthquake had a marked impact on philosophy and science. Many historians suggest the earthquake caused a fundamental shift in Christian thought. The political theorist Judith Sklar wrote, "From that day onward, the responsibility for our suffering rested entirely with us and on an uncaring natural environment where it has remained." The moral philosopher Susan Nyman called it the beginning of a modern distinction between natural and moral evil. The Lisbon earthquake was not, however, a universally secularizing force. The causes and consequences of the earthquake were very much in the eyes of the beholders. The French philosopher Voltaire, for one, was deeply moved by the human suffering in the earthquake and quickly wrote his Poem on the Lisbon Disaster, published only weeks later in December 1755. He rejected the idea that a benevolent God could cause the suffering seen in Lisbon. He wrote, "What crime, what sin, had those young hearts conceived that lie bleeding and torn on mother's breast? Did fallen Lisbon deeper drink of vice than London, Paris, or sunlit Madrid?" He rejected the prevalent ideas of philosophical optimism, that God created a good world, that any apparent evil was deliberate, that, as Alexander Pope wrote, "What is good." "And o'er this ghastly chaos you would say, the ills of each make up the good of all. What blessedness! And as with quaking voice, mortal and pitiful, ye cry, all's well." Voltaire's rejection of God's guiding hand here is often interpreted as advocacy of atheism. Indeed, the view of disaster as divine punishment is so deeply ingrained in the Western psyche that to reject it is seen as equivalent to rejecting the very concept of God. But Voltaire was a theist, though admittedly one who decried much of the work of organized religion. Voltaire's writings inspired responses from the philosophers of Europe, including letters from Rousseau. Rousseau adopted a more traditional view of God's involvement, essentially that there was purpose to the suffering, or else that the suffering simply wasn't that severe. Rousseau was already espousing naturalism, that much of the ill in human life came from being settled in cities and divorced from the fundamental peace of nature. In keeping with this idea, he argued that much of the suffering was caused by the decision to build tall houses in close proximity, and thus was a result of nothing so much as our free will. Further ill-advised human choices are cited by Rousseau. Decisions to return to burning buildings to retrieve valuables, for instance. He completes his discussion by arguing that we cannot reject God's influence or his goodness because we do not know what worse suffering the victims were spared by not living past that day. One has to wonder how depraved Rousseau thought urban life to be that he can imagine the Lisbon earthquake as a lesser evil. Whatever its impact on philosophy, the Lisbon earthquake furthered the notion that the physical world could be described and understood through the scientific method. It was felt by budding scientists across Europe and led to a flowering of hypotheses about its possible physical causes. Most drew on Aristotelian ideas about vapors in the earth, as the winds were one of the fastest moving features of nature that could be observed. It was not until the San Francisco earthquake in 1906, when a fault could be clearly seen on land, that the role of faults in creating earthquakes was first proposed. Still, the Lisbon disaster led to significant advances, including the first earthquake catalogs and the first recognition that earthquakes were not spatially random, that areas prone to earthquakes could be recognized. Outside intellectual circles, however, evidence suggests that the larger sphere of humanity continued to respond to random threats with familiar ideas of divine retribution. The timing of the earthquake on a holy day of obligation, at the exact time of the morning when churches would be at their fullest, seemed too significant to be ascribed to simple chance. It invited the question, why should the pious in their churches be stricken, while the prostitutes in the nearby red light district were, at least relatively speaking, spared? Modern science offers an explanation for even this discrepancy. In fact, we have three. First, Lisbon was originally settled as a seaport, and as noted, its first buildings were constructed in the sediment along the riverbank. Loose river sediment passes seismic waves more slowly than stiff soil or hard rock. To carry the same amount of energy at a slower speed, the waves have to get bigger. We see amplification by a factor of 10 or more in very loose soils. These soils are also subject to liquefaction. When soil is shaken, the grains settle closer to each other. We observe the same phenomenon when we fit a whole bag of flour into a slightly too small canister by tapping it on the kitchen counter. If the soil was saturated with water, as it would have been near a river, the compression caused by that settling would squeeze out the water held between the soil grains. That would raise the pressure in the water, and if the pressure got high enough, the sand could temporarily become quicksand, flowing like a fluid until the water could get out of the compressed space. Quicksand does a very bad job of holding up buildings. Reverend Davy, who described the tsunami, also spoke of sand blows, water and sand shooting into the air, which are a characteristic feature of liquefaction. Second, very big earthquakes produce more low-frequency energy, causing more damage to very large buildings than to small ones. Third, the churches were made of stone, while the brothels in the city's red light district were more likely to have been built of wood, and thus were more flexible and able to withstand shaking. Of course, people looking for an explanation of God's actions in 1755 didn't have the benefit of these ideas. They were living in a European society divided between the Protestants, who saw the Catholics as papist idolaters, and the Catholics, who had turned to the Inquisition to preserve the true faith against the ravages of Protestantism. In Catholic Portugal, many took the earthquake as a sign that they had been insufficiently zealous. Father Gabriel Malagrida, a Jesuit and a leading preacher of the day, argued that God had destroyed Lisbon because they had allowed too many Protestants into the city. It is significant that of the 34 people executed during the chaotic aftermath of the earthquake, most were Protestants. Voltaire ridiculed this in Candide. After the earthquake had destroyed three-fourths of Lisbon, the sages of that country could think of no means more effectual to prevent utter ruin than to give the people a beautiful auto-da-fé. For it had been decided by the University of Coimbra that the burning of a few people alive by a slow fire and with great ceremony is an infallible secret to hinder the earth from quaking. In the Protestant world, a response to the earthquake was much easier to offer. Here was God's proof that Catholics really were idolaters, the Inquisition inspired by the devil. John Wesley, a noted English preacher and founder of Methodism, opined that there was nothing that brought sinners to greater attention to God than an earthquake. About Lisbon, he wrote, "And what shall we say of the late accounts from Portugal? That some thousand houses and many thousand persons are no more. That a fair city is now in ruinous heaps. Is there indeed a God that judges the world? And is he now making inquisition for blood? If so, it is not surprising he should begin there, where so much blood has been poured on the ground like water, where so many brave men have been murdered in the most base and cowardly as well as barbarous manner, almost every day as well as every night, while none regarded or laid it to heart." A belief in God's retribution had very real consequences for the people of Portugal. Its conflicts with Spain had led Portugal to develop strong bonds with some of the Protestant countries of Europe. The ambassadors to Portugal from Great Britain and The Hague were the first to have audiences with King Joseph after the earthquake. And moved by the great suffering they had seen, they wrote appeals to their home countries for aid to the Lisboans. King George II of Great Britain pledged the huge sum of £100,000 as immediate aid. But for their part, the Protestant Dutch government declined to help. By their Calvinist thinking, if God had chosen to punish Portugal for its Romish idolatry, they had no place interfering. God had rightly decided what level of suffering they should receive. Chapter 3, The Greatest Catastrophe, Iceland, 1783. I thought it would be unfortunate if these memories should be lost and forgotten upon my departure, as have so many other works of God, which have, for lack of care, been lost forever. Jón Steingrímsson, Introduction to His Autobiography, 1785. Of all the natural disasters, volcanoes have the greatest potential for massive physical disruption. No single event demonstrates that better than the Laki eruption in Iceland in 1783 to 1784, which researchers believe is the deadliest natural disaster in human history. The total death toll was in the millions, and the devastation spanned the globe. We are lucky, then, that volcanoes occur only in a few specific locations. Still, how could a volcanic eruption in an isolated corner of the North Atlantic, an island with a population of only 50,000, where eruptions happened on average every 3 to 5 years, have led to so much death and destruction? To understand the answer, you have to consider the role volcanoes play in our planet's ever-shifting geography and the plate tectonic dance. Volcanoes show up in three different plate tectonic settings. The first lies under the ocean, forming what are known as mid-ocean ridges. These are places where the big plates are moving away from each other, and hot magma rises from the mantle, deep in the earth, to fill in the space left behind. The magma in the mantle is dense, so the resulting rock, basalt, is heavy. It sinks a bit into the Earth's partially molten mantle. Consequently, you find heavier rocks at the Earth's lowest elevations, the seafloor, and lighter minerals at higher elevations, the continents. It also explains why these volcanoes are mid-ocean ridges. Harry Hess, a geologist at Princeton University and a rear admiral in the Navy Reserve, had one of the great insights of the plate tectonics revolution of the 1960s. He realized that the volcanoes at the mid-ocean ridges were actually creating new seafloor, what he called seafloor spreading. Scientists had been speculating about the movement of continents for decades, since the geologist Alfred Wegener proposed the notion of continental drift in 1912. He had recognized the similarity of rocks and fossils in Africa and South America, so he suggested that the continents must somehow be pushing themselves apart, plowing through the oceanic crust like icebreaker ships through a frozen lake. However, because the continental crust is made of rock that's not just lighter, but weaker than the ocean floor, pushing continents through the Earth's crust would be like pushing a marshmallow through a brick. Hess's insight was to see that continents were not drivers, but simply passengers carried along as the lithospheric plates moved over the mantle. His argument is supported by evidence we find on the ocean floor, which is nowhere more than 200 million years old. By comparison, the oldest rock on the continents is 3.7 billion years old. But this raised a new question. If continents were shifting as a result of the formation of new crust, what was happening to all the old crust? The Earth isn't growing bigger, accommodating more and more oceanic crust. The answer lay in subduction zones. This is where two tectonic plates collide, and one gets forced down into the Earth, where it is melted and eventually recycled, at rates of 1 to a few inches per year. Rocks created at the mid-ocean ridges exist for anywhere from a few million to 200 million years before being subducted into the Earth to be reabsorbed. It is this motion that's responsible for the second occurrence of volcanoes, those that lie above subduction zones. As with Vesuvius, a subduction volcano is one that results from a plate being gradually forced down into the Earth until friction with the overriding plate melts the rock, which then rises through the upper plate, emerging as a volcano. In addition to those in Italy, subduction volcanoes compose the circumpacific Ring of Fire, including the many volcanoes of Japan and the Pacific Northwest. The island of Iceland is an exception. It represents the third tectonic setting in which we see volcanoes, hotspots. There are a few places in the Earth's mantle that are particularly, inexplicably hot. Hot things rise, of course, and so plumes of magma come up from deep in the Earth, irrespective of what's above them. Hawaii, Yellowstone, Galapagos, Reunion Island, and Iceland are the most notable of these hotspot volcanoes. Iceland is unique in that its plume coincides with a mid-ocean ridge. The island of Iceland, as we know it, exists because a hotspot has caused considerably more magma to head to the surface than in the rest of the mid-Atlantic ridge, which is still below the ocean surface. The oldest rock in all of Iceland is 13.5 million years old, younger even than most of the ocean floor. Every bit of the country, which is the size of Tennessee, was created as a result of a volcanic eruption. It has dozens of subpeaks, but it's fair to say that the whole country is essentially one very big, active volcano. Formed in the middle of the Atlantic, Iceland has never had a land bridge to other continental areas. As the polar ice cap melted at the end of the last ice age, about 12,000 years ago. Iceland emerged as a pristine land without people. Birds, plants, and sea mammals abounded. But the only land mammal found in Iceland before human settlement was the Arctic fox. The first humans to find Iceland were most likely Irish monks. Irish tradition says that St. Brendan the Navigator sailed through the North Atlantic in the 6th century AD and arrived in an island he called Tila, where foul-smelling rocks fell on him and his fellow monks. When the Vikings from Norway arrived in Iceland in the mid-9th century, they found Irish hermits near a dale on the southeast coast that they called Kirkjubæur, or church farm. The first of Iceland's Scandinavian settlers were two men and their households. Ingólfur Arnarson and Hjörleifur Hjörmarsson were blood brothers, having sworn allegiance to each other in the Viking custom that demanded that each avenge the other in the event of one's murder. The story of their settlements is recorded in the Landnámabók, land-taking book, written a few hundred years later. It functions as a foundational myth of the country of Iceland, the stories they tell themselves about who they are. The book reports that Ingólfur had brought high seat pillars with the story of his family carved into their wood from his old home. On approaching Iceland, he followed tradition and threw the pillars overboard, swearing to make his settlement where the pillars washed to shore, so that the gods could show him where he should live. Hjörleifur did not indulge in such superstition. He came into the first good harbor. Ingólfur's pillars washed ashore in a bay bordered by steaming hot springs, which he named the Bay of Smoke, or Reykjavik. Hjörleifur, meanwhile, settled on the southern shore near the old Irish monks Kirkjubæur. Struggling to establish a farm, Hjörleifur pushed his Irish slaves so hard that they rebelled, murdering him. Ingólfur discovered what had happened and avenged his blood brother, executing the slaves. He lamented Hjörleifur's sad end, but found his death only to be expected for someone who ignored his people's rituals. The settlement of Iceland was completed over a few decades, from AD 874 to 930. Involving about 10,000 Norwegians and their Celtic slaves. Norway was in turmoil at the time, with its king, Haraldr the Fair-haired, trying to consolidate his power over the chieftains. Up until then, the king was considered more of a first among equals, but Haraldr conquered several small surrounding kingdoms and demanded taxes from his fellow chieftains. Meanwhile, a burgeoning Norwegian population was running out of easily accessible land. And so a new land with open fields and no natives was a great draw, in spite of its distance from Norway, or perhaps because of its great distance from the king. Because so many of Iceland's first settlers were rebelling against King Haraldr's newly imposed taxes, the resulting culture was remarkably egalitarian for its time, with local chieftains and farmers, but without a king. The chieftains, in Old Norse goði, from the word for god, played both a political and a priestly role. No cities were formed, not even villages. The people were spread out in farming homesteads, gathering together once a year at the Althingi, the world's first parliament. Since those first foul-smelling rocks fell on St. Brendan, volcanic eruptions had been a part of Iceland and its culture, albeit a very dangerous part. Farms found themselves covered in lava. Eruptions under nearby glaciers resulted in sudden melts, causing massive surge floods. But the same forces that caused so much disruption also provided an important source of heat that made life there viable. Iceland had been forested when the Vikings first arrived, but the minimal yearly growth of trees through the island's very short summers and the tendency of sheep brought on longboats from Norway to feed off young saplings